If you have an off-the-shelf product and you just want access to my membership list to put them together, you will sell some stuff. I will make a little bit of money off of royalties, but it's not going to change anyone's life. They were started in 1958 by a retired teacher who discovered that one of her retired friends was ill and living in a chicken coop and had no access to healthcare. There was no public health insurance at that time. No one in the world was going to sell health insurance to someone over the age of 65. She thought that was a problem that just had to be solved.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Hey, so Chris Vaughan, welcome to Partnership Plus. I'm super excited to see you given that you're in Chicago and I am in Sydney, Australia. It's amazing how this web thing works.
Thanks very much, Phil. I'm glad to be here.
So, Chris, we're going to talk a lot about associations today, and that's because a good chunk of the last period of your life has been spent focused on how to make associations better. But before we get to all of those topics and all the things you do day by day, let's dive into this very interesting backstory that goes well beyond your professional career. Like, what is the Chris Vaughan backstory?
Well, my first fun fact is that I am trained as a philosopher. Strange but true. That is a life choice that people make.
Love it.
I wanted to teach. I really wanted to teach philosophy. That was my passion. So I went off and I got a PhD in philosophy and then went looking for a job. And there was this newsletter called Jobs for Philosophers and it looked like this at the time. My friends thought they were funny and they bought me a t-shirt that said professional philosopher will think for food. So obviously I needed a plan B. As luck would have it, I got a job working at a local computer reseller where ultimately I was recruited into a consulting firm that became one of the fastest growing and most successful consulting firms of the 1980s. Mm-hmm. It was called, based here in Chicago, it was called Whitman Hart at the time. It grew to 10,000 people in 30 countries all over the world. And I made partner very quickly. And interestingly, for this conversation, found myself in charge of some of the largest alliances in the tech industry at that time. So we'd had a very large $100 million deal we did with Novell to combine our services and their technology all over the world. We did a very large deal with Microsoft, a $70 million deal to develop what would become ultimately one of the first precursors of cloud computing here and in Europe. So I ran those alliances until the dot-com bubble came, and obviously everything changed.
We hear a lot about this term alliances in technology, and there are armies of people that look after alliances, and it's evolved from what you would have helped pioneer, the way that some companies work together, try to forge technology that never existed before, right now to today where we are just SaaS rich and there are more partnerships and business models flying around that little ecosystem. And a lot of people think that it sort of lives there, right? Like alliances really live in technology. I don't think that's entirely correct. I think it exists right across different areas of the world and different industries. But what was that like trying to forge those really early partnerships when technology is still very, very early, right? And there'll be people who are listening to this who won't really have any recollection of what it was like to hold a floppy disk. And this is some of the stuff that was happening back in that time. So what was it like to sort of forge those kind of partnerships back then?
It was exciting and it was frustrating and it was really hard. The internet was new, right? We were dealing with companies that kind of invented the network, companies like Novell, right? It was their idea.
Yeah.
And Microsoft was trying to get way out ahead and invent what would ultimately become SaaS, but was 10 years away from that at the time. And they needed something they knew not what. Right. So they needed a services arm. We've got the technology, but we don't have the people to implement it and service it. Do you have people who can do that? Let's do a deal. I mean, that was really the spirit of the thing with Microsoft. Do you have people who can develop this kind of technology for us on the side? Because, you know, our team can't do it. Right. Are you the guys, that kind of thing? But there was no template for that. Right. It really hadn't been done before. So we were kind of making it up as we went along. Right. We did big deals. They put a lot of money behind them and they threw it out and said, you know, you guys just go figure it out.
Right.
That part was really exciting. The frustrating part was, I think now the structure of these deals is better understood. what needs to make it work. I've read your work. I agree 100% with your philosophy, but we didn't do any of those things right at the time. Right? We had none of those things in place. We really weren't aligned, I think, on what we ultimately wanted. We weren't aligned on values at a certain level, and certainly in one of the deals. So they succeeded insofar as they could, I would say, at the time. And then the dot-com bubble brought an abrupt end, you know, really to all of it. But I never thought of it as pioneering, but I think it really was. I mean, there really wasn't anything you could point to in the tech industry or in the tech trades at the time to say, you know, look, this is how these deals get done. I think we really were out ahead of it.
And so when you think about a deal that sort of cemented your love, that we'll get to the associations in a second, but was there a deal that is super memorable for you where you sort of go, ah, so this is how this is done? Was there one of those that sort of stays in your mind from those days which really sticks with you?
In the technology industry, yes. We did a deal that I was not personally involved with, but was very close to with IBM that was done well. And I think it's because IBM had more experience doing these kinds of things. I think that's more woven into their model, right? This yep. kind of concept of doing partnerships, at least at that time. And the IBM relationship went extraordinarily well. It grew really, really, really fast. The relationships were strong, but it was very clear, right? Mm-hmm. What we were trying to do, what they wanted from us, what our role was, what their role was, and how we defined success together.
Right.
It was almost a flip the coin. You know, they were the template, I think, for how you did these deals. And, you know, they did a lot of the things in your book well, right, that we hadn't done. I kind of wish they put me in charge of that one.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Like the benefit of hindsight for all of this, and this is, we just talked about before we got here, you know, the idea that I come at this with is I'm almost an archaeologist trying to work out all the bits that went on, the luck, the tenacity, the grit, the uncomfortable conversations that led to magic happening that unfortunately one day will be forgotten. But when we go back into this idea of intent, you know, when people say, it was very clear. What I often find is that people will have had time to have three or four conversations where they develop a shared language. They get a sense about what exactly each other is talking about. And whenever I hear somebody say, we had a great first meeting and I think we can move to a contract, I tell them to run in the other direction as quickly as they can.
Right.
It's impossible to sort of forge that kind of language. And I think, you know, for the ones that we've spoken to, the teams at Microsoft, at Amazon, where there have been some really interesting partnerships in the early days forged, and they've got down to a fine art of crafting a shared language within the first three meetings. And it even comes down to people asking really dumb questions. What do you mean by this thing? And then all of a sudden light bulbs go off. And instead of there being 12 meetings to get to that point, they've had three, and it's so fruitful that they then feel comfortable bringing a lawyer into the conversation to build a contract around it. So I find that intention step so important to make sure that people aren't going to misunderstand what happens a year or 2 years down the track.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I would add to that, that process builds the necessary trust, right, in the relationship, right, of hammering that out, right? You know, what do we mean and how are we going to talk about this? And sort of getting to know each other, being transparent about things that are maybe uncomfortable, right, about gaps. Right, or issues in your own business that are relevant to the conversation. I think absent that, things get really tough because things are going to go wrong, right? There are going to be problems. And if you don't have that foundation of trust and understanding to work through all those, these things fall apart very quickly, as I'm sure you well know.
Yeah, I get it. And it's interesting. Ryan Hawke was telling me just a few weeks ago about a fantastic quote from General Stanley McChrystal, who says that trust reduces transaction cost. And it's amazing how over time, that becomes a completely true statement. So super interesting. Now, you are in a pretty unique situation where your business partner is also your wife, and you've been building this fantastic relationship, which looks from the outside to be a very formidable partnership where you've both come from big consulting. You've spent a lot of time understanding what works well, what doesn't work well. And you and Lisa have worked out that associations are a place to occupy and become leaders in terms of offering consulting services and advice, which might ordinarily not be made available to associations. So let's set the scene for the European and Australian and Asia Pacific audience. When we talk about associations, tell me what that means in that language, so that we can sort of ingest that here. And why is it that you both decided that associations were the place to play?
So associations are very simply your membership organizations, right? Where individuals or companies or both come together for a common cause, right? And to promote the common good. And that could be anything and is. So every profession, medicine, dentistry, law, engineering has many associations that are serving that industry with training, events, publications, research. The list goes on and on. It could be around causes, for example. It could be around animal welfare. It could be around disease research, et cetera, et cetera. And they exist in every country. There's 3,000 of them in Australia alone. There's 40,000 of them here in the United States who are our clients. And in our view, after 20 years of doing this, associations really make the world go round, right? They are the catalyst for the connections that make modern industry, technology, and life possible. They really do change the world, and we can get into more of that. But that was the one, what excited us about associations enough to commit ourselves to it 100% when we started this this firm. We had met at our former consulting firm, sort of at the end, right, as the dot-com world was crumbling around us. We fell in love, and we got married, and we quit in 2001, and we started this firm, Sequence Consulting, in our kitchen with nothing but a dream and a domain name. And went looking for clients.
That's a pretty good start, right? Pretty good start.
As luck would have it, we found our very first client through a partnership that we had established with a major advertising agency here in Chicago. And our very first client was the largest association in the world. And it's called AARP. It's the American Association of Retired Persons. Mm-hmm. And their mission is to make life better for everyone as we age. So their members are people over the age of 50.
Nice.
And there's about 38 million of them, which makes them many times larger than the next. They make the 800-pound gorilla look like Curious George. I mean, that's kind of how big they are. So saying that that was your first client is like saying your first football game was the Super Bowl, right? That's what we walked into. But it was eye-opening for us. When we thought about that organization, like, oh, they got great discounts and they've got a great magazine and that's kind of what they do. And we started working with them and realized there was so much more than that. They raise hundreds of millions of dollars a year for senior poverty, right? They recruit thousands and thousands of volunteers every year to help low-income people do their taxes. They have national programs for driver safety and fraud prevention and brain health and caregiving, and the list goes on and on and on. You know, they are the defenders of Medicare and Social Security here in the United States. Those programs probably wouldn't exist without them. And our minds were really blown, right, to understand how much good was being done. And we looked at ourselves and said, you know, there are 3,000 people here who wake up every morning and do nothing but try to make life better for all of us as we age.
Yeah.
And we get to help them. We're in. We're in. This is what we want to do with our life. And we knew they, you know, they were the biggest, but they weren't the only one, right? So we have built our business on that experience with them, on that initial partnership with our ad agency. We learned a lot. We built a lot of credibility, and we've expanded our business with a mission to help associations grow membership and revenue. And we've been doing that for 23 years. We're still here. We're still married, which, which is the greatest success after all of that. But we've been very successful, but it's really, really rewarding because, you know, we really do feel like by helping associations be better, we're making the world a better place.
I totally get it. And I love that. How is it when you walk into a new client organization like this and you're trying to understand how to help them? There'll be some, I'm sure, some headline metrics that they're trying to move, whether it's to modernize, to grow membership bases, to increase their income. How do you sort of get to that point to understand what really matters to them? Because, you know, as specialists, you know, as experts in the field, I'm sure there can be many stories told of all the great impact and all the great things they want to achieve and what the next 30 years looks like. But ultimately, they've got to be around long enough to see that impact. So is there a process or a way that you found to try and get to the bottom of what maybe those core metrics are and how they would play a role in partnerships in the future?
You know, the metrics are clear and simple, right, in this space, which is a good thing. It's membership growth, right? Is the membership growing or not? And you can peel that back, you know, is retention, right? Are people renewing their membership year after year? Are we bringing in new members, young members? Those types of things to us are the diagnostics of, is your membership healthy?
Right.
And then revenue, right? Some of that will come from membership, but the associations have lots of businesses that they do, right? They have foundations and they sell publications and they promote events and they have lots of ways to make money. So is the top line and bottom line growing, right? Is your revenue diversified? You know, if you're getting all of your money from events, COVID comes along, you're done.
Yep.
So is your revenue diversified and is it growing or kind of the ultimate metrics of health? To your question about how partnerships serve that, in every possible way, right? Every aspect of associations business is an opportunity for them to partner, and they do, right? Associations are sort of promiscuous partnering organizations for a lot of really good reasons. They're very focused on mission. They have very limited resources. Like they can go out and get funding, right? You know, so they look to partners of all kinds to accomplish the kinds of things that they want to accomplish. They partner with for-profit companies to provide benefits right, yep. to their members. They partner with like-minded organizations to have more advocacy impact right, on policies and regulations. They partner with other not-for-profits to pool their resources to do research and have causes. I'll give you one example of that. My daughter, Britta, just graduated from George Washington University and got a job at the American Cancer Society. Mm-hmm. She is the manager for their national roundtables, and there are that's a set of I think 8 to 10 large organizations focused on particular cancer issues: lung cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer. But each of them brings together hundreds of other organizations under these umbrellas to share their resources, to do research, to drive clinical treatment, to drive awareness, to drive prevention in a way that none of them could do by themselves. She manages communications for all that. So we're, insanely proud of her for doing that. But it's a really good example of the kinds of ways associations partner that I think a lot of not-for-profits don't think about.
Yeah. And I guess that there's an interesting cross-section here where some organizations, the penny has dropped that the way to make progress is through partnership. And some others will go, actually, no, we can go it alone. We've seen many organizations said, look, we have a huge track record in going alone. We're going to continue doing that. It feels like in the world right now, which I don't think is in great shape, by the way. I think there's a lot happening in the world, which is not great. It feels like the idea of reaching out to forge a partnership, to have that conversation is probably more needed than ever before. Are you seeing that kind of appetite for your clients to go actually being partner-led is probably going to be something that provides us with a strong degree of redundancy in our future business to try and make sure that we are around long enough? Or is it, or are things staying more or less status quo?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there certainly is a lot of distrust, right, in the environment generally, right, not just our world.
Yeah.
A lot of divisiveness in our world generally that most of our clients try to stay away from, right? They try to stay under the radar of all that and stay focused on their mission. I think there's a lot more openness in this space for people to innovate and try new things. And I think that is because the pandemic rocked their world. Many of these have been doing business the exact same way for 150 years. And right. I don't exaggerate.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it blew up, right? I mean, everything that they thought about their business, everything they counted on and depended on about their business was thrown up in the air. And they had to very quickly pivot and reassemble their organizations in ways, as you said, in some cases, just to survive, let alone to thrive. And many of them were not aware that they were capable of that, right? I don't think they knew that they had it in them I'm praising them, right? I'm bumping down. They didn't know they had it in them to be that agile and to pivot and to work together as efficiently and effectively as they really did. And it was remarkable. And almost all of our clients ultimately did. Right. You know, they survived. They came out stronger than before. They learned their lessons. They've internalized them. And one of those is we have to do business in a different way.
Right.
We need more diverse revenue streams. We really can't go it alone. Right. We may be the biggest and the oldest medical society in the world, but right, we still have holes. Right. We still have blind spots. We still have opportunities for partners. So I think the mindset has shifted. Associations have been doing partnerships from the very beginning. I mean, if you think about association, it is a partnership at the very highest level. I think it's the highest expression of, you know, we're better off in this together, right, than not. So the mentality of working together like that is sort of built into the DNA of associations. Their ability to operationalize that into new spaces is new, is new for them. And a lot of the work that we are doing with associations lately is about exploring those things. What are some new avenues, spaces where, you know, we have the right to win, but don't have the resources, right? Or where, you know, maybe we're stronger together than we might be separate.
Yeah, that's a, I mean, that's a great problem to have, though. Can we just duck back to something you just said? We'll double click on this.
Sure.
This idea of organizations not knowing that they were capable of making that change.
Yeah.
So what I think is fascinating across the board is that there were organizations who thought they were ready for that kind of change. And then there were a whole bunch of organizations that didn't believe they were. And the commonality now, sort of having moved through COVID to a large extent, is the fact that they can all share that experience now. So there's a lot that can be sort of shared between both. Is there an example where one of your clients or somebody who was in the association sphere really genuinely surprised themselves a lot by implementing things quite quickly and moving to a new place that would be sort of an exemplar in that kind of field?
Yeah, I can think of several, but the one that really jumps to mind is the American Medical Association, which is the largest organization for physicians in the United States, and the only organization that represents the entire profession, and it's been around since, you know, 1850,
right,
or something yeah. like that. Clearly has been very, very successful, but, you know, the pandemic, you know, shook their world like it shook everyone else's. And they were able to pivot with remarkable speed, right, to a new way of communicating with their members. They put out monthly newsletters. They put out quarterly journals. I mean, that was sort of the pace of communications.
Yeah.
They flipped to doing daily updates, right? They were doing daily video updates on here's what's happening. Here's what you need to know as a physician, right? They were, you know, their email volume cranked way up with up to the minute information that physicians knew that they could trust and desperately needed, right? So they could treat their patients. And that required the whole organization to turn itself inside out because they had lived in these silos for over a century. And that just wasn't going to work anymore. They really had to find ways to reach across those silos and work together and move very, very, very quickly. I think they had no idea that they could do that. They had never been required to do that. I don't know that they, some people even wanted necessarily to do that. But when they had to, they did. And a lot of that is credit to the leadership at AMA and you know, their ultimately their chief experience officer. But they have kept it up. And I think that's one of the things I love about that story is they got through it. They believed it, right? We can actually do this. Our members love it. It makes us better. Let's keep going. Mm-hmm. And they have. And they're one of the most innovative clients that we have. They're one of the most successful clients that we have. We brag on them all the time.
Yep.
Right, we use them as an example all the time for other organizations. Of you know, this is what's possible if you can pivot. It's just it's a huge success story.
That's fantastic. And you know, we had a similar thing happen here where there was updates changing very, very frequently, as it was happening all around the world. But the ability to compute this amount of data and then make sense of it, put it back out, and then have the ability to have questions come back is very, very different. You know, the Blue Angels from the U.S. Navy will often say, you just got to hit that believe button. And at some point when a leader says, this is what we're going to do, everything can follow as long as people want to do that. And I saw some amazing camaraderie come off the back of COVID. In Australia, we had Norman Swan, who is one of our, they would call him a TV doctor, but he is a very experienced clinician that was appearing daily for a podcast to tell and communicate to everyday people what the research was saying, what the studies were coming out. And obviously there was so much volume of data for them to compute, not and then just also the number of cases we were seeing, where they were spiking, what the government regulation was. It was all coming through to a center point. They did that for a huge amount of time. And it seemed that every time they went to go and take a break where things seemed to be settling down, they would take a break and then there'll be another spike and they have to come back to the show and do it again and again and again. It was really quite something.
Right.
Really quite something.
Yeah.
So let's sort of change tack a little bit on this, Chris. Like, what do you see in the world of partnerships that leaders aren't seeing right now? You know, we talked earlier about this idea of, you know, there is safety in doing things together, and it can be up to the point of competitive advantage. People can do a lot of things to sort of safeguard and help make industries more robust. But when you see and you cast an eye right across what's happening in the US right now, and even further beyond, what do you think leaders are not seeing when it comes to securing opportunities that can come from partnership-driven growth?
I think when you think of partnerships in the for-profit context, I think supply chain, right? I think, you know, distribution, right? You know, you have a channel, I've got a product, let's push my stuff through your channel, right? That kind of thing, you know, maybe research and development. You know, my perspective is different because my clients are all associations and they have none of those things. And because they're not for profit and because they're ultimately partnerships, they're able to do things that associations don't think about, right? In ways that they don't work together, in ways that serve the for-profit industries. And I can give you a couple examples of how that might happen, sort of just a different, maybe it's a different paradigm for partnership, but this was one of the most successful that we've had the pleasure to be involved with. SAE International is the Society of Automotive Engineers. Mm-hmm. It's the global society for the automotive and aerospace engineering. The folks in that space are big companies, right? Boeing and aerospace and Ford and Mercedes-Benz, et cetera, et cetera. And they're ruthless competitors, right? It's a very competitive business. These are not people who generally want to collaborate right, with each other, right? They're trying to take each other out. But they have a lot of problems in common, right, that they have to solve. There are a lot of technical issues that need to be worked out and on which they need to agree in order to move forward. Let's just take one example. Autonomous vehicles, right? New technology. What are the rules? Right? What are the standards that we're going to use? Right? You know, what are the kind of core technologies that we can all leverage in a way to make this thing work to all of our advantage? There's no platform for them to do that, right? I mean, I imagine, right? You know, Ford and General Motors getting together. It's like, let's share our trade secrets, and I promise, I pinky swear, I'm not going to take them back and use them against you. It's just ridiculous, right? That this would ever happen. But because SAE is an association, they're able to do things like that. So the idea that they had was to establish a space for pre-competitive collaboration where organizations could come together under an umbrella, share the information they needed to, work out the things that they needed to work out, develop whatever they needed to develop, whether that be standards or a technology, right, or whatever that they could all share, and then go back to trying to kill each other. It's called the Industry Technologies Consortia, and they're kind of custom built partnerships, right? So the industry comes to them and says, we need to work out this cybersecurity thing for cars, right? If you imagine people can actually hack your Tesla. Can you imagine that? So that's a problem that needs solving. They can come together, they can form a partnership ad hoc. Maybe it's temporary, it might ultimately be permanent. They all pool resources and money to do it. They work it out together. And then it comes out under the umbrella of the for-profit organization. And it works, right? There's no government scrutiny. Yep. There's no antitrust, right, in that environment because trade associations are allowed to do these things. The association can facilitate partnerships like that because they are a trusted, right, convener of organizations. People can come together in ways they wouldn't with people that they otherwise wouldn't because, right, they have this platform for people to do that. That would never happen in industry, right? But it makes money. SAE makes money off of this. They've got over a dozen now in very specialized spaces. Some are funded by the U.S. Department of Defense you know, for long-term projects, et cetera. So it was a growth strategy for SAE to facilitate these industry partnerships, if that makes sense.
Yes.
One of the most successful models that we've seen, it stood up very, very quickly. It's grown very, very fast. They continue to grow. They've done some acquisitions under that umbrella, which is really interesting too. But it's a model, and we've seen that model replicated to a certain degree in other industries as well, because it's sort of a common need, right, for that sort of pre-competitive collaboration. I think when people think about, you know, partnerships or corporate partnerships, they're not thinking about that.
No.
But they should.
Yeah.
They should.
Absolutely.
Right? There's a need, and there's a way forward, right, for partnerships of that nature to evolve.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think there's also just an interesting capacity for trust to be built. So if there is a real clear and present risk inside the industry, those industry participants know exactly where to go. Right? That there's not a need to reestablish trust. It's already there. We can try and solve this problem.
And there's sort of a turnkey operational platform, right, to do that. It's not that we have to fumble around for 6 months and figure out how to get this done, right? There's the platform. You can just plug it in and go with your consortia for whatever issue you need. And that's a huge advantage, right, to the industry, is that it's been figured out for them. All the legal stuff and all the operational stuff is already in place. Brilliant. It was really, really brilliant strategy.
I appreciate that. And I think the other piece here is that when people hear the term partnership, I think often there's almost a romance attached to that word, which I think is usually pretty dangerous, right? The idea for most partnerships, or at least the intention, is for advantage to be gained by both parties simultaneously. Over the horizon that has been thought about. And what we often find is that there is a lot of well-intentioned, but people want to sort of shy away from how is this going to work? What's the reality of this that's going to come off? And we want people, frankly, to be able to make money on both sides of this equation. And if it's not money, it's value. And so when you sort of think about not-for-profits or membership organizations right now that haven't really thought through this, what would be your message to them if they're trying to think about, we want to be around for another 30, 40 years. We've been around for the last 50, 60, 100 years. How would you encourage them to think about modernizing the way they think about their strategy and their growth, given the experience you've had at Sequence?
Yeah, that's a great question too. There's a very old, venerable partnership model in the association world, right? It's the affinity marketing model, where association slaps their brand on someone else's insurance product and they push it out and they sell it to their members. It's been around forever. AARP invented it. They perfected it, right? You know, they started it in 1958 and they've, you know, turned it into a massive industry. And they do it really, really well. And they do it better than a lot of other people do. And here's the difference. This is the gospel that we preach to people on these things, is that those things work when they're custom. So if you have an off-the-shelf product and you just want access to my membership list to put them together, you will sell some stuff, right? Yep. I will make a little bit of money off of royalties, but it's not going to change anyone's life. If you really want to move the needle, you need to find a partner who's willing to customize their products for your members in a way that no one else will.
Right. Right?
And there are really good examples of that, you know, beyond AARP, who really invented the idea of, you know, group health insurance for older people. I have another example, a fascinating client. Their members are actual spies. They work for the U.S. intelligence community. And so they have a unique life needs, if you can imagine that.
Indeed. Right?
So
yes.
Let's say you're a covert intelligence agent operating undercover in, you know, Baghdad, you know, or Damascus or whatever. It's hard to get life insurance. You know, there's not a whole lot of people who are going to sign you up.
That is true. Yeah.
For life insurance. But you got a family, you know, you need to do it. Here's another problem that normal people don't have. So let's say you're an executive in an agency like that, and you get called before Congress to testify. That is $1 million legal bill that someone is going to have to pay. What liability company is going to take you on and say, yeah, we'll cover you if you get sued or prosecuted or Congress wants to rake you over the coals? Their association does those things for them because they were able to negotiate with third-party for-profit insurers to underwrite those risks in return for exclusive access to people who desperately needed them.
That is brilliant.
They've been doing it for a very long time. They're the only people, I mean, they have competitors, but they're only people who serve the entire community. And as you imagine, the member value in that is off the charts.
I mean, enormous.
Literally, it's the only way they can protect their family. It's the only way they can protect their income. That's one of the brilliant examples we've seen of how people do that. Off the shelf doesn't work. We actually encourage a lot of people to just trim their list of third-party products completely and get rid of them, you know, and only sell the stuff that's unique and you know, really has a right to win in the marketplace, and some do. Now that this is a simple example, but liability insurance for a psychologist, right? Clinical psychologists is unique, right? Their needs are different from doctors, right? They're different from lawyers. Their association has negotiated liability insurance specifically tailored to the kind of problems that they have and the things that they might get sued for. It's only available through the association. So the member value is huge and the revenue is good. And I mentioned both because in our view, one is more important than the other.
Right.
You make money off these things, and you can make a lot of money off these things if you want. The member value is in many cases worth more than the revenue, right?
Yes.
If it's a reason people join, if it's a reason people stay, the lifetime value of a member to you is vastly more in some cases than the royalty that you're going to collect from these members. So we encourage organizations as they think about partnerships. So where can we add unique value, right? revenue aside, you know, yes, let's talk about making money. No money, no mission is what we say. But let's think from the member back, or where are there unmet needs that we can creatively partner to fill to grow the membership and add value?
I love that. I love that. And, you know, it's really, what's really piqued my interest on this idea is, particularly for that liability cover for the people working in the security services, there must have been someone at the beginning who said, you know what, we need to get insurance for these people. And you can imagine the person who had a very clear idea, or people, team, who had a very clear idea that that was the need, and then having to walk in, possibly there were some relationships at play, likely cold calling, having very primary conversations about, listen, we need insurance coverage for a great number of people, and you will never have priced this risk before in your life. In fact, you probably don't have a product for this. Can we work on this together? And sometimes it just takes a bit of courage to say, hey, listen, could we work on this together? And for, you know, eight of the no's, you'll get three of the yeses, and that's where industries are built, right?
That's right. I mean, the ARP origin story is a good example of that, not to keep coming back to them, but they were started in 1958 by a retired teacher who discovered that one of her retired friends was ill and living in a chicken coop and had no access to healthcare. There was no public health insurance at that time. No one in the world was going to sell health insurance to someone over the age of 65. She thought that was a problem that just had to be solved. She started the organization, and she talked to 42 private insurance companies who told her to pounce off.
Yeah.
There was no way they were going to underwrite this risk until she found one guy who was willing to start a company, start an insurance company just to do this, and ended up being probably the smartest man of the century, because it's turned into a multi-hundred million dollar business ultimately. But it was the vision, right? It was the clarity of vision of a real need that had to be solved, and then the persistence, right? To keep asking, keep asking until you got to the yes. And that was the persistence that not only built an organization, it built an industry. I mean, the partnership model that I've been talking about started there. It transformed the association space. It also transformed the insurance space. I mean, this was an entirely new channel to market insurance that had not existed before. I mean, it was a tremendously transformational move by a retired math teacher who felt bad for her friend.
All that needs to happen is that someone needs to ask, right? Fundamentally, it's just got to start there with a clear ask and then just work through the process. This is something else. And I would love for those people listening to this and seeing this episode who are in Australia, in the UK, we have some outstanding member organizations. And as a former serviceman, you know, our return services leagues and the other organizations that support veterans that come home, you know, obviously they've been in existence for a really, really long amount of time. And to their credit, they've been modernizing quite significantly as we've transitioned from supporting World War II returned veterans from then into Vietnam. And then there was a lull, and then we entered into, you know, the most recent chapters and theaters of war. And this has now forced them to evolve even further, because now those infrastructures were not really fit for purpose, right? For what was going to happen for younger veterans coming back and then having to support their families all the way through their transitions and beyond. So for anyone who is listening to this, I thoroughly recommend you go and check out Chris and his firm, who have done a power of work. They've got a whole bunch of white papers that have talked about case studies and how it's all played out. And a lot of the words we've talked about here today come from very straightforward approaches from people saying, I can see a need. I'm not quite sure it's bespoke enough for my membership group. Reach out, ask the question, and one good meeting will lead to another. So this has been fascinating, Chris. I mean, we're going to get into a rapid fire in a second, because I'm keen to hear your answer to some of these questions. But tell me, if you had to tell a membership organization one thing to leave them with today, what would you tell them as a piece of advice?
Be open. Be open. Think about new approaches. Think about new partnerships. Think about new models for the relationships that you currently have with your partners. There are models out there that will work for you.
Amazing. All right. Are you ready for this rapid fire? And I will declare that I may or may not have taken, borrowed, shamelessly stolen questions from other very interesting podcasters. So if you hear this and you go, wait a second, I've heard this somewhere before, Look, there's a good chance. They're just good questions. So let's start with this. Number one, complete this sentence. Partnership is?
Human nature. Partnership is human nature.
I love that. That is awesome. What is the last book you read and loved?
The last book that I read and loved, it's called The 10-Second Customer Journey, and it is by the Chief Experience Officer of the American Medical Association, Todd Unger, who is a client and a friend. And it is a very simple, crystal clear distillation of all the lessons he's learned in his career around customer experience that transformed that association. It's a lot of the work that we've done together. It's a lot of the great work that his team has done. I think it should be required read forever.
Well, we'll link to that in the show notes. We always love a good new read to add to the list. Now, this is something that a lot of people will say by default, I wouldn't listen to my own advice when I was 20 years old. But what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
I would say every successful person has felt like an imposter. It means that you are doing something right. Listen to that voice and push through it. I believe that that's true.
That's terrific advice. Now, this is very much a Brené Brown question. So Brené, if you're listening, it'd be amazing if you are, but if you are, this is one of yours, so I hope you don't get too upset. What's one piece of leadership advice the universe keeps reminding you of that's so good you've got to share it, or so bad that we should avoid it?
Have the difficult conversations now. Don't put them off. Don't avoid them. Don't wait. There's a saying, I think it's a Finnish saying, what you leave behind you, you will find in front of you. Life keeps serving up the lesson until you learn it. That's one I keep getting over and over and over again. It never works out for me. So thank you for reminding me to remind myself.
I am now going to be taking that piece of advice as well. It's a fantastic piece of advice. And so, Chris, one last question. Question five. What's one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
I have to pick one. I am deeply grateful.
I'll give you three. You can take three.
I think it's three in one. I get to do what I love with the person that I love and make a difference every single day and get paid for it. That is what I'm really, truly grateful for in my life. I feel very, very blessed.
That doesn't get much better. So, Chris, when people are listening to this, we're going to link to a bunch of things in the show notes, but where can people find out more about the work that you and Lisa do at Sequence and beyond?
Come check us out at sequenceconsulting.com. You can find out about our work and our clients and some of our case studies and how to contact us there.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.